teams that are doing expertise. One of the teams is called UMD ACE. I got there, can't find the other user study thing. So I'm sure I've got it, and I just can't find it. Is there somebody on that team that could, like, send it to me?
I'll put it through them.
Okay. I will send you back comments on it tomorrow.
But,
okay. In the meantime, a couple of changes to the syllabus or clarification. So you'll notice we go from T3 to T5, right? You'll also notice that I promised yesterday or last week that I would tell you what T4 was. So we have solved that problem. Okay? Don't worry about it. I need other things to worry about. But what was happening was that some teams were doing things that could generate ground truth in advance and other teams weren't. And so if you can generate ground truth in advance, fine, generate it in advance. You can build your system at the last minute. Otherwise, you've got to build your system a little early so you can do the evaluation. I don't care which order you do it in. It was there to keep you from having everything on the last day. But that's really the only purpose of the survey. So it's gone. Second thing is, we did three of these system walkthroughs last week. They were done really well at just the right level, which is here's where we are. And here, look, you can see it on the screen if you like. But, you know, here are the issues we're working with. These are the things we're, the way in which we're trying to approach it. That's what we'll do this evening for the research project update, which is, say, all the other things that are not the the projects that we did last week. And then the interface demos next week are not a big deal. They're an opportunity, if you have an interface, to put it up and get comments. So if you can be ready to do that next week, that's fine. If not, you can certainly use the time the week after to get comments as well, so that the times near the end of class are available for feedback from the class for you, if you would like to do that either of these times. Questions on any of this? Okay, so this week, oh, questions on anything else? So this week, the subject is speech and music retrieval. And this has an unusual structure to it. So usually what happens is that either I tell you about general ideas and give you a few examples, or I tell you about really general ideas and wave my hand a lot. But very rarely do I do what you're going to be expected to do a couple of weeks from now and give a project report, right? I haven't gotten up here and taught a class in which I gave a project report. So that's what I'll do. I'll give you a project report this week. And I've been doing a project on speech retrieval. So I'll tell you how we do user studies in this project, how we do batch evaluations in this project. You'll get to see what do the analyses look like. Now, you probably will not be able to do as complex a project as the ones I'll describe. Actually, you may be able to do as complex a project as the first one, because the first one is a single student working for a semester. So, six people working for a semester, you should certainly be able to do at least as much as one student did in the semester. The second one is 35 people working for 5 years. So you probably don't want to try that one. But you can see all the kinds of evaluations we did. Right? All the ways in which we think about measuring things and setting up questions. So that's one of three things. The third of three things is going to be, that's actually the second of three things in the project report. The third of three things is going to be the time that you have to see what other people are doing in their project. And the first one is the usual thing where I'll stand up here and wave my hands a lot. So speech retrieval, and that will include the project, and then a little bit of time for music retrieval at the end. So here's the basic setup of the problem. If you want to search the spoken word, you have to think, what does that mean? You might want to search news broadcast. This was the first thing that people worked on. This is a relatively easy problem, because people speak in a carefully structured way. They get fired as a news broadcaster if they don't speak clearly, right? So they also talk about things with a fairly limited vocabulary, so that everybody can understand what they're saying, and so this is a relatively easy problem. On the other hand, you might get a bunch of people sitting around a campfire telling stories. Oh, that could be really difficult. Particularly if you didn't have a good microphone for the people that were telling the stories around the campfire. You could pick a whole campfire pot and all that sort of thing. And you could find all sorts of other things. So, give me an idea here. If I asked you how much printed paper is there in the world, how much, let's separate that. How many electronic files, how much content in electronic files, we'll just measure words for each one of these, in electronic files of character-coded text, the first sort of stuff we started searching, and how much speech there is, how would you compare these? Which one would you say is biggest?
Speech.
Documents. Documents, printed documents, like in the library. Not the ones online, like in Google.
Oh, but words.
Yeah, which one's bigger? Which one has more words?
Sound. Oh, which one has more words?
More words, yeah.
In current context?
It's yeah, today, right?
Electronic media.
Electronic, so like the web pages.
So
character-coded text, much more than speech, right?
But speech means speech.
Recorded
it's been
recorded?
Speech?
Yeah,
okay.
Okay.
The thing I'm
going to
start thinking of talking about this.
There you go. That's and it's being recorded, right? So the real question is not recorded speech, but recorded bold speech, right? So here's the way you do the computation. How many of these are there in the world?
A billion.
That actually turns out to be the right number, right? There are roughly 1 billion of these, so the population blank 6 billion. And about 1 billion people on the planet have one of these. If you're in Korea, you replace it every 4 months. Right? In the United States, you keep it for 2 years because your service contract requires it, right? So that's 1 billion of these in current use. Okay? Now, this is merely a device for digitizing speech. I mean, it can store it or it can send it or whatever, right? So it's a device for digitizing speech. There are a billion of them on the planet. How many hours a day is their speech recordable by it? How many hours a day do you spend talking?
There's 24 hours in a day.
One.
How old are you? One. Yeah. If you're a professor, the number is larger, right? But, you know. So you're going to give me 2 or 3 hours, maybe? So that's 2 or 3 billion hours of speech are recordable every day.
That is valuable.
Ah, now that's the excellent question, right? So, in the first place, we could compute how many words there are. So there are about 100 words a minute, not an hour, if you're from Texas, or about 200 words a minute if you're from New York, right? So you could just figure 150 words a minute and you'd be somewhere here close, right? Okay, so many, many more words spoken in a day than there are written in the Library of Congress, right, by people that could digitize them if they wanted to. Okay, so how much of this is useful, right? And the answer is, most of it's not. But some of it's phenomenally useful. Yes? Well now, what other problems do you know that's like this? The web, right? How much of that is useful? Hardly any. But what is it that makes the web useful?
Search,
right? If you can find the useful stuff. So if there's useful stuff scattered around those billions of hours of conversations that are going on, and you could find them, that would be phenomenally valuable, right? I mean, think of the implications for knowledge management. What do we try to do in knowledge management? We try to move the availability of the idea as close to the generation of the idea in time as is possible, right? In my organization, I want to be able to find the ideas that are needed by the people that could use them as soon as they're generated. Well, I can only find them now as soon as they get written down. But if I could find them as soon as they got spoken, I'd be one step closer to finding them as soon as they got thought. We have the the journal in Congress, right, that keeps track of what they say. And they're constantly saying things like, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to insert this book in the record. We have 14 days to revise and extend our remarks, right? Well, why don't we just have the remarks and be done with it, right? You either said it or you didn't, and we'll just have the thing that you said. Who writes history? It's actually not the winners who write history. It's the writers who write history. It's the winners who hire them, right? Who give them the grant. It's the writers who write history, right? So if I want to know about the history of some coal mining town in Appalachia, where do I find it? Well, I find what's written about the coal mining town in Appalachia. What is it? That's the government's activities in this coal mining town, right? It's the business's activities.
Or you ask the oldest person there.
Or you ask the oldest person there, but they don't write history. So what I want to do is I want to get the oldest person in town to tell me their story. What's that?
Oral tradition.
Yeah, the oral tradition. So last night, I went and I listened to a fellow who had given a talk to the Veterans Oral History Project, the Veterans History Project at the National, or at the Library of Congress. And he had been in World War I and in World War II. And in the year 2001, he was interviewed. Right, so this is one old fellow. And he talked about what it had been like, and how many times he left the Army and got back in the Army, and you just got a whole feel for sort of what the piece of the society he moved through was like. But if you looked at his service record, it would just tell you the places he was at and what he did, but it wouldn't have given you that kind of a story. So, if not history, in the sense that historians think, and this is not based on the documentary record, but it is the other side of the story, or one of the many other sides of the story. Okay, so you can do an awful lot with this stuff. I mean, gosh, there's Nixon's meetings, there's Johnson's phone calls, right? If you're a C-SPAN junkie, you'll listen to the Johnson phone calls, you're like,
he's practically impossible to understand.
So sometimes these are difficult. Yes? Okay. So here are a few statistics. The largest collection in the world of oral history, this is the sort of misnamed discipline of people who collect these memory projects for academic purposes. So there are public memory projects as well. But academics have sort of used this moniker oral history that historians hate. And the largest collection in the world is in the British Library, and it's in 100 different sub-collections. And the average length of one of these is 12 hours. So it's a 12-hour long interview about somebody's life. Now just imagine what a Google search for this would look like. Oh, found you 200 interviews, top 10 shown. Let's see, 12 hours a piece, that would be 120 hours just to listen to it, just to tell if that's what you want. So I have to give you a summary of it that allows you to decide whether you want to see it, but this is hard because it's speech, right? What does a summary of speech look like? Okay. Do I chop out all the interesting parts and put them together really tightly so you can hear them? Do I put the words up? That's not speech. Okay. So am I really summarizing speech with just two words? Okay, so there's the smallest problem we have. It turns out that there are 4,000 radio stations around the world indexed by a single source, so they're probably more than this, a little over 4,000. And there are about 8,000 hours in a year. Now, many of them are broadcasting the same content, and a lot of what they put on the air are music and things like that. But still, there is an awful lot of audio, and it would be really valuable to be able to search for this. I mean, could you imagine if you were proposing some change to the tax code, right? So there's this alternative minimum tax thing they're talking about, and the question is, can we raise taxes on certain people so that we can lower the alternative minimum tax? And this must be getting people on talk shows, like, all up in arms. But how many people are in favor of it, and how many people are against it? And wouldn't it be nice if we could float a trial balloon and the next day come in and see that we had 17,000 phone calls that were for it,
had 3,000 phone calls that were against it. I mean, if I came in and I told you, hey, I heard a whole lot of people against it, that would be true. There were 3,000 people against it and 17,000 people for it. So I'd like to be able to just sort of process all this audio from all of these radio stations and find out what the heck's going on. But right now what happens is that if I put a web page up on the web, somebody will crawl it. And they will take that web page and they'll contribute it, if I'm lucky, the copy of the web page to the Internet Archive. And you'll be able to see it 20 years from now. But if I say it on the radio and it's broadcast over the Internet, when the bits get to the other end of the Internet, they're dead. They're gone. Nobody's collecting them. So all that stuff that's going on in our society is just vaporizing. Right? And the reason it's vaporizing is because if you stored it, you could never find out what you stored. Here's a question. Could you store all the speech you hear in a year? Could you afford the disk space to just take, you know, just walk around with this thing right here? Anybody's talking to you, it's pretty clear you're recording it, right? The little sign on it, I am recording. Right? So could you store that without going broke? What would it cost?
Just space. This space is the cheapest part of the equation.
Okay, do you have any idea? Is it $100 or 1,000?
1 terabit is around $300 to $400.
$22 in disk space to store every word you heard if you were talking or listening continuously, 16 hours a day, the entire time you're awake, but very rewarding for sleep. $22. And next year it'll be cheaper.
I can afford that.
What's that?
I can afford that.
Right? And you could probably even afford to copy it over when the disk started getting old, right? You could keep multiple copies. You could send it to your friends if you trusted them. Yes? So storing the stuff isn't hard. The reason people store things on the internet is because they can search it. And the things they can't search, they don't store. So if we create search technology, it will create storage of all those radio stations. Because it's easy to store. In fact, you could conceivably record every word spoken by every human on the planet. And it would take about as much disk space to do that for a day as we build in a day. So, of course, you then couldn't store anything else, and you couldn't copy it anyplace. But you could actually store everything. We build disk space faster than we talk. Okay, and so we went through the phone calls there. I showed this picture once before, did I? You've never seen this?
No.
Okay. So, what does it take to make the World Wide Web? Why do we have a World Wide Web? Well, one reason we have a World Wide Web, probably not the way you think about it, is we can either store this file on my computer or on your computer. Well, where would I like to store it? I'd like to store it on your computer, right? I mean, why do I want to use up my disk space? Where do you want to store it? You don't care because it's so damn cheap. We could store it anywhere, right? If disk space is expensive, I don't give away my disk space for free and let you use it for free, but disk space is cheap. In fact, in 1995, disk space was so cheap, you could store 300,000 words for a single US dollar, which isn't worth as much as it was. Some of the story. But now, speech takes more space to store. Right? Speech is larger per word by a healthy factor, but disks are way cheaper. So even by 2003, you could store way more spoken words than back at the dawn of the web, you could have stored written words. So nobody cares what it costs to store all this speech. I mean, this class is 35 megabytes with the video. Like, who cares about 35 megabytes? Okay, so how many different conversations could be going on the internet backbone? Well, I mean, put this up before Skype, but we live in the world of Skype right now, right? How many people can talk to each other on Skype at the same time before the internet comes crashing to its knees? The answer is that we completely overbuilt the internet. So just inside the United States, you can have 30 million simultaneous communications in a country with only 300 million people, right? I mean, you just don't want to talk to a lot of people. There's no problem at all moving this stuff around. Just like there was no problem moving text across the internet backbone in 2003. The same thing for getting things to people's homes. In 1995, we finally got a modem fast enough to get a web page to a home in a single second. One page of text, one screen full of text, we could get to your home in 1 second through a 14.4 kilobit per second modem, right? So, of course, we've never had any problem getting audio through phone lines. That's what they were designed for, right? So you just shouldn't worry about that. And in 1995, that was the year. The year before that, only 5% of the U.S. population had a graphics card on their computer. The year after that, 20% of the U.S. population did. That was the inflection point when it went through 10%. And so the graphics part of the web started to become widely accessible. And so all of these things caused, in 1994, the Lycos search engine to take off, because that was the one remaining thing. Was if you could find it, there was no reason not to store it and to transfer it and do all the other things. And now with speech, there's simply no reason not to store it and transfer it and do all the other things, if you can find it. Right? So there were these two alternate approaches, SpeechBot and SingingFish, that people came up with in 2003 to find it. And here's how they work. SpeechBot would take whatever you said, run it through speech recognition, at which point we had held the elephant's nose and it turned blue and we had words and we could search them, right? So that was the SpeechBot approach. And that had the limitation that it was fairly slow, because you had to run a speech recognition system, which required a lot of processing power, right? And the speech recognition system would make mistakes, of course, just like OCR. SingingFish took the completely opposite approach. They said, I don't know what's in there. How would I know what's in there? Nobody cares about the speech anyway. Everybody wants to find the music. Right? So this is way too hard a problem. Can't run speech recognition on music. Let's just find the name of the song, and we'll index that. So if the MP3 file has a little metadata in it, we'll just index it. If it doesn't, we'll look at the name of the file. If that doesn't work, we'll look at all the links to the file. We'll just use all the stuff outside that describes it, and we'll do that. So SpeechBot was able to do, oh gosh, I think at its peak, they could do 15 hours every single day. They could add 15 hours to their index, because it was one machine sitting in, you know, some lab in Cambridge, Massachusetts, right? SingingFish had 35 million unique audio files in it. Now, you can only ask about the metadata they had, but they had way more stuff than speech models. So what we really want is we want the system that's halfway in between SpeechBot and SingingFish. We want scalable, but we want content-based. This is what we have today. So this is from last night. The question here is NASA Apollo, because if you just put in Apollo, there's apparently some band named Apollo. And if you just put in NASA, there's apparently some band named NASA. But if you put in NASA Apollo, the first thing you find is Wide Awake on the Sea of Tranquility, which is explaining why the first guys that landed on the moon had trouble going to sleep. It wasn't really something that seemed to need much research, if you ask me, but in any case, there's a podcast about this where people are explaining, you know, what it's like to be on the moon. Okay, so they've taken the SingingFish approach. In fact, the simple solution with SingingFish was just to buy them, which is actually what America Online did. so AOL certainly is saying this.
Now, at this point in the semester, you should realize that there are lots of ways to index things. And what that is rank retrieval based on associated text. But we could equally well do controlled vocabulary indexing, and this is what they do in the British Library. Right? Or we could do social filtering, right? Collaborative filtering. Nobody really cares what it is we're rating. We can be rating amusement park rides, beer, election results, candidates, anything we want. Why not rate audio files? And so the piece we want to focus on is feature-based indexing, but that's only because we already talked about it. Correct. So there are fundamentally four ways in which we might do this. One of them is to do full transcription. So we just have a person who types what was said. Now you're thinking to yourself, this doesn't make any sense at all, right? Because who's going to type all that stuff? People have said way more of it by the time we get any of it typed. But of course, for very valuable things, like some people did the LBJ tapes. They had transcripts of every word LBJ said on every tape. Why? Because he was the President of the United States, and we got telephone calls with him talking to people that didn't know they were being recorded. So, you know, he was foolish to say some of the things he said, but he was talking to people that didn't know they were being foolish. So it's very valuable stuff. So lots of things get transcribed. So that's perfectly reasonable. We could do that. We've already talked about associated materials. Here's a really interesting one. This idea of annotating things. We ran into a group that would take every interview. Did I tell you about these interviews yet? These are interviews with Holocaust survivors. Yeah. And they would chop them up into pieces and then annotate them. It took them 10 hours per hour to do this. And they did it for 10,000 hours of material. But by well-trained, highly paid people. Well, who, well, of course, thought they were getting paid enough. But. So you can do this with manual annotation. Okay, that's the problem. Start to get to the solution. Let's say that I wanted to do speech recognition on a on an utterance. So I want to take something that I say and do speech recognition on it. So I'll give you one to practice on. We'll do how to recognize speech. Right? Anybody know where this goes?
How to recognize
speech, right? How to wreck a nice speech. Get it? Or how to recognize speech. How to recognize speech. Now, we can do simpler ones. Ice cream. I scream at the top of my lungs. Yes? Your ear hears one and not the other. Why? The context.
Attention.
Okay, good. So I have to tell the machine the context.
That's going to be hard.
Right? I mean, this thing hasn't graduated from elementary school. And I'm going to explain to it the context of ice cream?
Well, that's the thing, too. So it's like the core.
Probability?
Yeah. So this is what it does. It reads the New York Times. And it reads the Wall Street Journal. It reads everything that has ever been written that it can get its hands on, and it counts how many times ice cream appears immediately before at the top of my lungs. And then if it guesses at the top of my lungs, it'll guess I scream, because ice cream was never said just before at the top of my lungs. Only in scientific papers, right, where people would be talking about weird things that actually happen. Okay, so what we want to do is we just look at the possible multi-word sequences, and we guess which one is said. So that's the end of the story. The beginning of the story is I have to figure out how to take what was said and just make it a bunch of sounds. Yeah.
If you're calculating the probability that it follows something, how do you calculate the probability of the first word?
So you calculate them jointly. You say, I'm guessing I could tile these words onto those sounds.
Okay.
Or those words. But it's going to be one or the other. And so I can calculate the probability of one and the probability of the other using the trick I showed you a while ago. You multiply the probabilities together, put your hands over your eyes, and you hope for the best.
Okay.
Yes? So it's a language model.
Right?
Okay. Except in this case, it's a four-gram language model, four words in a row. So it's probably this four words, those four words. And if I read enough of the Wall Street Journal, I'll see lots of four-word sequences, some of them over and over again. Today, the stock, that must appear in almost every Wall Street Journal. Right? So I'll see lots of patterns that are very common. And then if you say something common, I'll probably be able to guess it. If you try to outfox me and say something really weird, well, man, hippie garden on saw I path, it won't get it right.
People talk to lots of different people every second.
They do. They do. So this doesn't work so well. But it works a whole lot better than not having. And in fact, if they're talking in Czech, like in Prague, they really talk differently. Because in Czech, they have a colloquial form that they use in speech. And so what we do for our Czech system is we give it Czech literature, where people are writing in the colloquial style. And the machine learns to transcribe as if in literature.
Right.
So we have to give it representative literature. And of course, there's not as much Czech literature as there is in the time, so there's a limit to how far you can go in that direction. Okay? Okay, so that was step three, which words could go together. Step two, which words do I know? So I have to have a list of words I know and what sounds they're associated with. And then the first thing I need is a way to get to the sounds. Right? To take the vibration on the microphone and make it into atomic sounds. So here,
the elephant's nose again.
What's that?
Are we going to hold the elephant's nose again?
We'll get there. Okay, so here is a representation of the uncertainty. This is an actual representation from inside a speech recognition system. And it thinks here you said, manage. The word manage. All right? But you might, instead of having said ma at this time, you might have said hmm at that time and oh at that time. So it's got uncertainty about what you said and when you said it. And then you compute the probability of every path through the lattice, and you take the highest probability path. Clear what's going on? So you have these tiles that you can put down that say this word is pronounced this way, that word is pronounced that way. And you fit the tiles in order, and then you ask, what's the probability that those words would have occurred in that order? Yeah?
So are you breaking down the words also?
Well, when it comes in, you don't know where the words are. I don't pause between my words, usually. Right? So we have to learn where the word boundaries are, but we take the words, we break them down into their sounds. And if we can recognize each of the sounds, even with error, then we can start to guess which path is the most probable.
We're breaking the words into sounds?
We're breaking the sounds into sounds. We get all we get is sounds. So I got sound coming in, I break it up into little itsy bitsy sounds that are called phonemes.
What's the say phoneme letter?
This is a phone. You know, phone and phoneme are used interchangeably.
Oh. Okay.
First time I saw it called phone, I was like, wait a minute. They left off something. But it's interchangeable. So here I've got the sound for M, right? And here I've got a, ne, je. Okay. So from this I get manage. So I just get the sequence of sounds. That's what comes to me. I tile the words I know onto it, and then I ask about the probability.
The machine knows all the combinations.
Yeah, now is it clear why it takes so long to do speech recognition? Because it has to actually generate that and compute the probability of many such paths. It actually doesn't compute the probability of every such path.
But in a search, how will you search many people that have many ways of
saying? Oh, yeah. This could be a problem. Yeah, this is exactly the problem. So if I can convert what people have said into words, then I can just search the words. So I move that problem into the speech recognition system, and I say, well, I have some people from Texas, and I have other people from New York. So I will train it on Texans and New Yorkers and see if it can learn. Or I could design a system in which I say, I have a Texas-New York classifier, and it decides whether you're from Texas or from New York, maybe by how long you talk. Right? And then it passes it to the correct speech recognizer. We actually do that. So the standard approach, which is called vocal tract length normalization, is I first build a classifier that guesses how long your vocal tract is. And vocal tracts come in three lengths: child size, female size, and male size. And so the machine will stereotypically pick a set of speech patterns for men, for women, and for children. And since we don't get a lot of children on the news, they just skip that one. Right? And if you do that, your speech recognition gets better. Okay. Politically incorrect speech recognition. Now, let's say that I have found that I really like this sequence of phones, which are now phones. So then what we could do is we could say, okay, these look like characters to me in speech space, right? These are kind of like characters. I'll just make trigrams. So I got this trigram, and then this trigram, and then this trigram. So it's these three, and then these three, and then these three. Make sense? So I've got these little word snippets. I don't worry about where the boundaries are between words anymore. And this works just like n-gram retrieval with text. It's a little messy. It's a little like shape codes in OCR, right? They're not quite right characters, but they act a little like characters. So this works okay. But the problem is, and now if you think about the language model, my language model has to be built on phones, not on words. And so now, something three or four phones away, I can keep that degree of context. But three or four words away, that's a lot of phones. That'd be really hard. I'm not going to have a language model that does that well. So word-based systems are more accurate for search than phone-based systems, with one little exception. And that is the word-based systems, remember they had to tile the words on? If they don't know the word, they can't tile it on. Right? And if they've never seen the word used in the Wall Street Journal, they don't know where it's likely to occur and where it's not. So the word-based systems get really bad, but only on words that don't happen very often.
That's really interesting.
Ah, and that's what the class is about. That's the key observation. The words searchers use in queries are the ones that have high IDF that find exactly the documents they want, right? But you're exactly the ones that the speech recognition systems miss. So for those, you need phone targets. Yes? We can skip the rest of the class. That's what the class is about. Okay. So I have to give you a little bit of background on this project. We started this project in 2001. It was inspired by a talk that was given by a fellow from the survivors of the Shoah Visual History Foundation. And what they had done was collected interviews with 52,000 people who were almost all survivors of the Holocaust. Some of them were witnesses to the Holocaust, but not survivors. Some of them were rescuers, but most of them were survivors of the Holocaust. And they collected this for their own purposes, not for speech recognition research. But they were interested in how speech and language researchers might be able to use this collection to improve their search technology, which would then benefit this foundation, who could then use the improved technology. So they were looking for some synergy with the research community. They had spent at that time about $100 million to acquire the collection, and they were not interested in spending any more money on the research side of it. They had an operational mission of making the collection available. So they were in the process of manually indexing it. Now, what that meant for us as researchers was that they had created the document collection and the ground truth, the manual indexing, that we needed to evaluate how well our search technology was working. They had also, for their own purposes, digitized the videotapes, the original that shot on Betamax videotape, and they digitized that, actually Betacam, so they digitized the Betacam to MPEG-1 format. So we had it digitized, which we needed if we were going to do speech recognition research, and we had a ground truth for doing our batch evaluations that you all understand now why we care so much about this, right? Okay. So we looked at this and said, gee, all we need is for somebody to pay us to develop speech recognition technology, and we need the speech recognition technology to be able to work well enough to be able to search it. Now, before this, there had been a set of experiments done in 1998, so this was about 3 years before. And here were the results of the experiment. That you could consider this problem as two problems. First, recognize the speech. Second, do the IR. And don't worry too much about how they get plugged together. Just plug them together. It'll work fine. So they've done this on news stories with news broadcasters, and it worked fine. And then it turned out that some people had built, back in 1998, really bad speech recognition systems, which was a great contribution to research, because now you could find out how the search technology worked with really bad and with really good speech recognition, and you can measure the effectiveness as you slid the quality style, the quality, not with artificial degradation, but with the actual degradations of really bad systems and really good systems. And it turned out that if you cranked up the error rate up to 30%, you got no reduction in performance, and then it sort of fell off the end of the world. And somebody came up with a very clever idea, a fellow named Amit Singhal, who runs the research group at Google now, one of the research groups at Google. His idea was, what kind of mistakes is the speech recognition system making? When it gets it wrong, what kind of mistakes does it make? And the answer is, it's awful. I mean, when it's good, it's very, very good, and when it's bad, it's awful, right? There's some trouble story. And that's what happens with speech recognition systems, because if I make a mistake, I just scatter all over the word space. But if I get it right, I use words that normally occur together. So what he did was he said, look, let's find out just where it's starting to go wrong. And let's take those documents and make them into queries. Let's think of the documents, the speech stories from news, which are pretty short, as if they were queries, and let's give them to a search engine, and let's search the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times. All the words that were recognized correctly will tend to pull up the right story. All the words that were recognized incorrectly will just be scattered all over the place. So
So we'll tend to find stories on this same subject, which we can take words out of and add them to the document. And guess which words they will be? In some cases, when we get lucky, they'll be the words that were missed. The rare words that are associated only with this story. And when they did that, they found that they could go out to 40% wordier words before they started falling off. And then went further than that, there was not enough signal left in the document to recognize its cousins in the news stories. You see how that works? Okay. So we knew when we started that if we had a 40% word error rate, we could do this. That was story number one. Story number two, we have friends who build speech recognition systems. And all they do, and here's how they do it. They hire, or they pay for free phone calls for people. And they have them call home and say, look, say anything you want, but please sign here allowing the U.S. intelligence community to record your contacts. So these people call home and they're like, hi, how's the weather? Anything going on? That's it, right? There's no content in here. So you couldn't like do if you could do queries, the people that participated wouldn't be too happy because you could actually find things, right? So they're having conversations about essentially nothing. And what they did was they said, okay, here's the deal. If you can make a really good speech recognition system, I'll give you $1 million. Okay, so that's a good transfer. And when people stopped working on it for $1 million, I said, $10 million. Make a really good one, give $10 million. People gave up on that. $100 million. They just kept raising the ante until people made really good speech recognition systems so they could find things like, hi, how are you, what's going on, really well. In fact, they got it to be so good that in conversational telephone speech, their word error rate was below 40%. At which point we said, hey, that's good. We'll just use it with Holocaust survivors. We're done. Send us money, we'll plug the two things together, we know it works. So that was our proposal. Right? Okay. You know how this story comes out now, right? It doesn't work. Okay. But it was a bad-ass proposal. Okay, so here's who participates. IBM. Now, there's this wonderful story about how IBM gets into this, which I could tell you, like, on break or something. It's nothing to do with the science, but the sociology of this is very interesting. The survivors of the Sherwood Visual History Foundation. Okay, so I have to tell you the story now. So there's this cocktail party one night. And Steven Spielberg is at the cocktail party. And Steven Spielberg is the largest donor, the founder of the Survivors of the Sherwood Visual History Foundation. He didn't pay all the money. Contributed to this, but he's the big man, right? And he's having drinks with Lou Gerstner, who's the chairman of IBM. And he says to Lou Gerstner, we got this problem. And Gerstner's like, we can solve problems like that. I'll send some of my people to come see some of your people. You know, the Hollywood thing, right? 9 research labs at IBM send researchers. They all fly out to California. This place is on the back lot at Universal Studios. Actually, inside Universal Studios. They all get the data, bring it back to their lab, and 8 of them realize that the problem is impossible. Now, why is the problem impossible? Well, I'll play it for you after break. But essentially, the problem's impossible because nobody that was caught in the Holocaust was from Kansas. None of them were news officers. And so they are speaking emotionally. They are all elderly. You only need a calendar to figure that one out. These are all the problems that haven't yet been solved in speech recognition. And so they come to the conclusion that it won't work. One researcher at IBM
who is pretty new, doesn't yet know what can and can't be done, takes this material and runs it through IBM's best speech recognizer from Call Home, this system I was talking about, and gets a 90% word error rate. Now, a 90% word error rate is actually a bit of an accomplishment. You have to know how it scored. So here's how you score speech recognizers. You take the words that were actually said, transcribed by a human, so a little bit of this had to get transcribed, and you take the words the system guesses. And since you don't know how to time align these, you give it the benefit of the doubt. You find the alignment that maximizes the score. And then you count the number of insertions, deletions, and substitutions. Now, it turns out that about one-tenth of the words people say are the. And about one-tenth of the words that the machines guess is the. It'd be pretty easy to make that machine, right? So, it does an alignment in which the does align. Whether they're near any other words or not, or whether they have anything to do with reality or not. So you get 90% just for showing up, right? Then you can work off the rest of your error rate over time. Okay, so in any case, this researcher gets 90% word error rate. So, they take the news system, the very best broadcast news system IBM has, which also gets 90% word error rate. So then they take the very best dictation system, via voice, so a publicly distributed system, via voice form, which also gets 90% word error rate. So they write a proposal to the National Science Foundation, which you may or may not have heard, does not fund companies like IBM. It funds universities. For $12 million, asking for money to work on a problem. And the National Science Foundation, rather than saying, no, but thank you for the lovely proposal, says, maybe if you can find a couple of universities to work with. So IBM comes to a couple of universities to work with, Maryland and Johns Hopkins, and we have 2 weeks to write the proposal. So we write the proposal and send it in, and they send us $7.5 million. For a problem that everybody knew couldn't be solved, except one person who didn't know that you couldn't ask. So you don't get what you don't ask for. There's a lesson. Okay, in any case, that's how IBM gets involved. That's how Maryland gets involved, the Center for Language and Speech Processing at Johns Hopkins. So Maryland is an IR group, Johns Hopkins is a speech group, and Johns Hopkins has, in an interesting idea at the time, decided to offshore their development of speech recognition systems, but not to India, to Prague. Now, why would they offshore their speech recognition systems to Prague? Well, for two reasons. One is they actually wanted to develop state-of-the-art speech recognition in Central and Eastern Europe. That was one of their strategic goals, right? You could go to the National Science Foundation and say, we want to help people in Prague get good at speech recognition, and they would say, we'll do that. Or if you go and say, we want to help people in Berlin get good at speech recognition, they go like, they like have money in Berlin, if they wanted to get good at speech recognition, wouldn't that be okay? Why do we have to pay for it? So this idea of developing the capability. The other is that there was a fellow who had developed the techniques that people use for doing speech recognition based on his Markov modeling. His name was Fred Jelinek. He wasn't the first person to come up with it, but he popularized it, demonstrated how well it worked while he was at IBM. And then he moved from IBM to Johns Hopkins. And he was at Johns Hopkins, and you're saying to yourself, Jelinek. Where's Jelinek from? Turns out it's Jeff. Yes? So all of this works back through, and it's the sort of sociology of research of who works together. People that know each other, want to work together. Okay, so that's where the team comes together. Okay, so I'll tell you about learning from our users. I'll tell you about the project first. We'll take a break. I'll tell you about learning from the users and the, so this is the user study side and then the technology side. Okay?
We actually did it backwards. Before we built the technology, we did user studies. Which is a little confusing. What's that?
From the user build perspective,
not backwards. There you go. And then I'll tell you at the end what we're not going to do, which is a lot of stuff. You've seen that already. Not already. So this was the basic idea. Because we had a bunch of people who worked on speech. They would build systems and write papers. These people who worked on language, they would read their papers. They would build systems and write papers. These people who worked on search, like what we do here, they would read their papers, build systems. These people who worked on interactive search, they would read their papers, build systems, and nobody would ever read their papers, right? And so what was happening was the speech people were sitting here going, hey, that's cool, 41% word error rate today. Maybe we can get it to do stuttering a little bit better. You know, I'm going to work on stuttering for 4 years. Right? And the people who were here, and they were like, well, the best one I ever saw, you know, when I started this, I did a survey. And I found one that was working on helium speech. So I was thinking, you know, this would only be useful at parties, right? You know, I got my speech recognizer, it'll even work when I'm breathing helium. And I'm like, wait a minute, you can kill yourself breathing helium? There's no oxygen in the helium, but it turns out what they do is if you're on the seafloor, very deep, they, instead of using nitrogen and oxygen, they use helium and oxygen. And so there really are people out there doing helium speech like for months at a time. And apparently they need speech recognizers. Okay. So in any case, there are all these people working on all these speech problems, and they really don't know about the search side. There are people working on all these search problems, and they're reading papers, but they don't really understand what's going on. So the really interesting thing in this project was these people would build something, these people would find out it didn't work, and these people would fix it. So that was the justification for taking your hard earned capital to do this. These were all the people in the end, so we landed up with a group of people around the world. We sort of had a diaspora. We had people move to Asia, people move to the UK. You know, we had a new group come in Budapest, but we're doing Hungary, so ultimately kind of a very large project. Let's take a break and I'll set up an audio demo so you can hear what it is, and then we'll go into the user space. 10 minutes?
So maybe you want to have two questions.
Two questions.
One about the topic, that you know this topic before, experts in this topic. Did the system work well for this topic? And then you want another one that asks about the system. Needs things like that. It's very common to have a topic by topic question.
Very short.
And system by system.
Keywords, We should find those signs. I can tell you.
Excellent. Okay. Yeah, I will send that. Let me send myself a note. And then she was trying to get home.
Yes.
Yeah, I can
delete it. Oh, yeah. Yeah. So we'll pull this out. Yeah. Oh, okay. They found out that they were taken to another city called Luka.
Okay, so we have stopped the recording here for a moment. Actually, we stopped recording the audio, if you're still sign language. Because what I'm going to play for you is an actual excerpt from an interview. And we have permission to use these in presentation, but not to post these on here.
We have to turn off.
But that's if your cell phone is recording everything.
Oh, we're being recorded.
No, I've turned that on. Great.
I was 14 when Czechoslovakia was there, and then it came home.
then after the 100 years, before that I belonged to an organization called SOCO, which was also an athletic Czech organization. And of course when that disappeared, that sort of donated actually our region to Hungary. Then I joined a Jewish athletic organization called the MAC. Oh, absolutely. But we kept the well, of course, they began to be angry, and you know, we were sort of slowly, systematically, and they just second person. But for a while, we were still free, we were still in our homes, the family was together, and then they started to take the men, which was labor camp. And so my father was taken for a while. He was there and released and came back home. And my brother was taken to a post-labor camp as soon as he graduated gymnasium. And after that, he escaped later from the camp and became yes. Let me tell you that my brother was actually taken from his classroom, from his graduating classroom, and a few other Jewish boys. They were taken out of the school and they disappeared. I remember that my family was devastated. The government did not have
to take them today. Okay, so let's see what we'll get back. So you hear that there are words in there like gymnasium that we probably won't get right. There are words in there like Sachar or Maccabi that I can't even pronounce because I have no idea in what context these words would be used. So we've got a very difficult problem of vocabulary. In addition, we have someone speaking with an accent, and there are many accents represented in the collection. So one of the things that makes this very interesting from a research perspective is to get those, to get systems that will work well across a broad variety of accents. Yeah?
What about the two different voices and the different quality of the voices?
So there are two microphones. One is oriented towards the interviewer, the other is oriented towards the interviewee. They're normally both placed on a table, and this is recorded in stereo. It's digitized in stereo, and for Czech, both of them run through speech recognition. For English, what we do is we select the microphone with the highest average energy, and we believe that that microphone is the interviewee, and we sacrifice some performance on the interviewer, right? With the assumption that the interviewees in this collection are trained to say things like, uh-huh, tell me more, rather than, on what day were you born, right? So the information content in this collection is intended to be from the interviewee as storytelling. In a different collection, you would have made a different decision. There's information in both, and they were handled differently in our two systems.
But isn't the speech recognition engine picking up did you say you're isolating the interviewer from the Czech speaker?
So both microphones pick up both speakers.
Right.
Right? And so in Czech, what we do is we simply process both of them and throw everything in. In English, we try to guess which one to pay attention to.
Okay.
That's two different designs, yeah.
Does the system confuse how she's talking and he interrupts her? Does it confuse? I know there are different microphones.
Right, it does not know when it's switching speakers.
Okay.
So it does have a guess at every time whether it's listening to a man or a woman. And it does understand that speaker switches occur. So sometimes it will try to guess when to make the switch. If it sees a speaker long enough, it will try to adapt to the way that speaker talks. And this collection is interesting because they're relatively long interviews. So you get a lot of speech from the interviewee, and the interviewers interviewed many people. So there are opportunities to do research on adaptation, long-term adaptation, which you can't do with short phone calls, for example. Other questions? So you have an idea of what it is the machine's trying to do, right? You probably heard yourself sometimes you couldn't have transcribed that accurately. So we pay people to transcribe these for, it takes them 10 hours per hour to transcribe them, and they transcribe every breath, every lip smack, every sound, so that when the speech recognition system is guessing what was said, it has as much information as is possible to line it up with. We selected, this is work done at IBM, we selected 800 people, 15 minutes from every one of the 800 people, so a total of 200 hours of material was transcribed at a cost of a person year of effort, 2,000 hours of effort to develop the transcriptions, just for English. So we started out running some user studies. Now, when we wanted to study how people use the collection, we were very fortunate that the Showa Foundation, the people who had the data, had already built search systems. And they'd already annotated things with a thesaurus, so their search system used a database. Several of you, when you started in this class, thought, well, we'll just use a database to do it. And that's exactly what they did. They manually annotated things and used the database to bring out the sections people wanted using a thesaurus-based search. We went and we got 16 searches. The first time we did this, we didn't really know who to study. So we studied people from a broad variety of fields. The first thing we learned was studying scholars is very hard. Because we would ask one scholar, what do you need? And they'd tell us. And we'd ask another scholar, what do you need? And it was completely different from what the first scholar told us. And so we'd ask the third scholar, what do you need? And it was completely different from what the second scholar and the first scholar told us. And finally we said, why are all these people so different? And they said, well, if we're all the same, we can't get tenure, right? We have to do something new. So scholars are bad to build systems for, because every scholar is trying to do something different. You can't really get past Google. Right? So if you want to try to do something specific for scholars, it's a hard job. But along the way, we had a fortuitous thing that occurred. We had a high school teacher in that first group, and one of the scholars had been a teacher. And the teachers had a very defined work process. They had defined little segments of an interview that they could use in their class to illustrate an idea. And we thought, cool. If all the teachers are going to do that, all we need is lots of teachers. So we went out and we got lots of teachers. We got master teachers from around the country to come in. They were all high school teachers, and they worked in teams. Ann Weeks came out from our school library media program to work with the teachers, so she could translate for them and say the geeks meant to say was, and you know, say it in teacher. Then we ran a backwards user study. The way you normally run a user study is you have one professor, wise professor, drinks coffee while the graduate students are working, and then you have four graduate students, one sitting in front of each person who's searching. And the graduate students are doing all the note taking, right? So we ran it backwards. We brought one graduate student and four professors. And so the four professors, this is really hilarious, were sitting here taking notes while the graduate student was ordering the coffee, you know, and making sure that, you know, we knew which questions we were supposed to be paying attention to and all the things necessary for the study. And the professors who were doing this were not the professors who did user studies. They were the professors who built systems. So we had no clue why these people were doing these things. We were looking at them like, and we were talking to each other afterwards. Like, I can't believe they did that. That doesn't make any sense. Don't they know how this works?
And so it was just a wonderful learning experience, right? They normally put glass walls between the people who build systems and the people that use them, just for the safety of the people that use them. So I was one of these people writing down notes. Okay, so it was really quite exceptional. We did very rich data collection. So you couldn't search this without understanding the thesaurus. So what we did was we got the people who had indexed the materials, the catalogers. We got them to serve as reference librarians, because there were no reference librarians for this collection. They just had a bunch of indexes. So the indexers who indexed it came out, and they had to learn at the same time how to talk to the searchers, because that wasn't something they had experience with. So it was right back at the Thorlaus, and he was teaching. You got to have a picture of this.
Wow.
He was teaching the indexers how to be reference librarians. Right? Okay. Anyway, so we instrumented that interaction, right? We actually put a tape recorder in the middle of this, and everything, somebody said, how would I search for socioeconomic status? They'd say, socioeconomic status is not indexed, but father's profession is indexed. Okay, how do I search for father's profession, right? So we take that discussion, and we would get it recorded. Then afterwards, we wouldn't have interviews like you guys are talking about. I read your things you said, we'll have an interview. We had interviews like, we'll have an interview, and we will ask questions like the following to learn things like this. Questions like this to learn things like this. So these were scripted interviews, but they weren't read the script. They were, this is what you want to learn, what you want to ask in order to get this kind of information. Okay. The observers took notes. The participants hand-wrote notes. Lots of them wrote extensive notes where they found one thing and were going to use that term in the search later, so they jot it down. So we just swiped their paper, right? And Xerox didn't give it back. And we ran screen capture on it. So, and in addition to the screen capture, because the screen capture software freezes sometimes, we have video cameras behind each of the monitors, shooting the monitors. Because what you can't see with screen capture is keyboard action, but you can with video cameras. So we had this enormous amount of data. And then we had, and this is what none of you have yet, a theory. And the theory said, we think people search for information in the following way. And so now when we do coding, that theory guides our questions, the questions guide our coding, the coding then changes our theory, right? So we're in a theory generation loop with the main purpose. This was the search system they used. So in some other screen, you type in the query, and then it would bring you to this. So this is like 2002 now. And so you would get the keywords from the segments. So this one is about education, family life, Cologne, Germany, socioeconomic status, divorces and separations, religious holidays, Jewish, Germany, 1920, June 6th through 1923, August 12th, and a few more things. So this was one segment. And then you could hit play here, and it would pull it off of a tape robot. I mean, this was really antique now, but this is how it was done. The robot would go whoop, 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 and actually put it into a tape player, roll the tape forward, and a little message would come out for those, please wait no more than 15 minutes. Right? Or if it happened to be in cache, you'd get it immediately. Right, and then you could watch that segment of video, and when the segment ended, the video would continue to play. And our scholars, half of them, just wanted to watch the video. This was a very high-tech VCR, right? But our teachers, none of them wanted to watch the videos. I mean, they wanted to watch the videos, they didn't have time to watch the videos. Okay, so here's the theory. The theory says that you have an information need, so you make a query, right? You do a query, you get the results, that's your situation. You look at the results and you say, that's not what I wanted. I wanted something else. So then you take some action. What's your action? You pose a query. Right? The query creates a new situation for you, and you continue around the loop. Right? This is Brenda Durbin. Okay. So then we can go hanging the things people said, the things that we coded on this theory. So we can say, how many things, how many kinds of things did people remark on or show up in the notes or whatever, when they were in the process of looking at results, right? So they're going from recognizing the situation to figuring out what the gap is. And how many things were involved in both going down, so browsing, and going up, formulating the query? And how many things were involved only in going up? And this was the first big surprise of the study. Nothing was involved only at query time. So what was involved only at browsing time? Well, things like how long was it? You know, I'm a teacher, I want to use this in my class, I'd like to have something that's a few minutes long. This segment's 10 minutes long, it's too long for us. Why didn't people include that in their queries?
Because we didn't let them.
What's that? Because we didn't let them, that's right. Query language didn't have restrict by length. What did we learn from this? Maybe a query language that had restrict by length would be useful. Richness and emotion. This is how well the story is told. This is the degree of emotion with which the story is told. Never at query time. Why?
Didn't have star ratings on
these. We didn't have star ratings on these things, right? Okay. So there were some things that were only in relevance judgment. There are some things that were in both places. So, for example, people occasionally get results back that were in a language somebody didn't understand. Okay, well, they didn't use that. Or they were speaking in ways that just were too thick an accent. But not surprisingly, topicality was numero uno. Now, if you look at the literature on this, topicality comes out on top all the time. So topicality came out on top. We were thinking, okay, how interesting is that? Well, here's how interesting it is. There are many aspects to topic. In Trek, topics are subjects, right? So we search newspapers by subject. I want to find stories about train wrecks. Okay. So subjects turn out not to be very popular in this collection among our searchers. But our searchers are asking about are people, places, and events. I was actually confused by this until I talked to somebody that understood people, right? Who pointed out to me that anybody who came to this collection, very high-tech thing. They actually had to fly from Moscow, one fellow flew from Moscow, to Los Angeles, and stay for a week to do this. Few of them are going to ask, what was the Holocaust? I mean, that's just not the sort of question you'd ask when you got there, right? You'd show up well-prepared, you'd know your subject really well, and you wouldn't be asking subject-oriented searches. You'd be asking about people, places, and events. Okay, so this was really interesting because you remember that Trek collection and the news stories and the 40% number? Subjects. Yeah? So the real question is, how do we do on people, places, and events? But how do you know that you have to do people, places, and events? How do you guys know in your projects that the queries you're using are representative of what real users would use? Well, obviously you do a user study. Chicken and egg problem, but okay. So we didn't actually understand the implications of this at the time we did it, but that's what people cared about. Here was another really surprising answer. This floored us. We thought, can you believe thesaurus-based searching? They should be using the new stuff, Lucene, right? Actually, they do use Lucene because they have a bunch of data you can search that way. But we thought, this thesaurus-based searching is going to be hopeless. I mean, the thesaurus was made for scholars, and here we are using it with teachers. This isn't going to work. Well, it turned out that 40% of the searches relied on the thesaurus. Okay. So we're learning a little something here. We should pay attention to, in our world, classification. We got this lovely thesaurus around. Let's not ignore it and count the words. Let's
find the thesaurus terms that are appropriate for this argument. Okay, so this changed our entire research program, right? We had not expected that result. We found teachers did something else that really blew us away. So what we had thought was teachers show up, there's something they want, they search for it, they find it, they put it in a lesson plan. It's not quite what they expected, so they change the lesson a little bit until it is, right? We never wrote down what we thought was going to happen, but if you'd asked us what was going to happen, that was sort of our mental model, right? Not what happened at all. We broke the teachers up into two groups. Half the teachers went to plan a lesson. The other half the teachers immediately went off to search. And then they swapped, because we only had four search stations and we had a nice round table. And then they swapped back, and then they swapped back again. So we got to see, everybody got to do a few iterations of this. And we would have spies sitting under the table while they were talking around the table, writing down everything they were saying. And then they go back and search. That's the search process, right? And what we found was, people would say, I found this really great little segment here. And we gotta make up a lesson plan around it. And so they were deciding what to teach based on what was in the collection. And then they would say, let's go find more of these. And then we'd go back to find more of these. And then find something else. And they would come back and change their lesson. Not jigger their lesson. They would just teach what was in the collection. It was a remarkable collection that nobody had ever had this kind of access to before. And they were making up a reel of interview segments that other teachers could use. So we found that the collection was writing lesson plans, essentially. You can use the teachers to do it. Okay, well, we had to actually design systems to do that. So this is an actual example of that. So the teacher says, yesterday in my search, I felt like I was going around in the dark, but then we did a writing session and that directed my search. So that's what we kind of thought, right? But then we looked at the two testimonies we found before we started writing the lesson. We really started with the testimony about our lesson around it. That's the one we had to expect. Okay. And they kept going back and forth. So we have another theory. And the theory says that people don't select things when they're searching based on what they see in the interface. They have a criterion in their mind. What they see in the interface informs the criterion, and the criterion informs the decision. So it's a decision theory approach, right? And so the question is, well, what criteria are they applying? So we just sort of listened and coded the criteria that they were applying. And we found all kinds of criteria. So for example, here's one I hadn't expected. One criteria was whether they would get fired if they used this. We hadn't thought of that one, but they thought of it immediately, right? Because you'd come across some stuff in here and you'd say, boy, that would be great to use in my classroom, except I think I'd get fired. Well, okay, I'll bet you they don't. And they did. So this is the one that really blew me away. The age of the interviewee at the time the event occurred. So these people are in their 70s. And the kids, of course, are all 14. Or all 12. They're stratified by age, right? So the teacher's got a set of kids that are, let's say, 14. What are they looking for? Somebody who was 14 when this happened to them, right? Not one of us had ever thought about it. But the teachers just mentioned it to each other and all nodded and went on. There wasn't big news for them, right? It turned out this is the easiest thing to do, because we had metadata with everybody's birthdays, and all you had to do was fly a slider bar for I want 14-year-olds, and they're all 14, they're all the interviews with 14-year-olds. This was trivial, technically. We had no concept that it was what their name was. We actually had heard this once before, only I had heard it. Nobody else that was there. And the way we had heard it was, do you know about this intergenerational design team that Allison Drua does? Yes? So, for those of you that haven't heard of it, the usual way in which you build software for kids is that you get a bunch of kids, you build a bunch of software, and you test it on the kids. Right? Kids are sort of like your instruments to see if you build good software. So who sends up the software?
Adults.
Well, adults, because they know how to build software, right? Kids don't know how to build software. Well, I even didn't. So what she does is she brings kids together and she has them design software. They just design what it's supposed to do. And then the graduate students go off and build it, bring it back, and the kids test it and tell the graduate students what they did wrong. So it's an intergenerational design team. And we did one of these 2 weeks ago with the Apollo moon landing thing, right? And the kids were just all over it. And they were latched on to things I'd never thought of, like, they didn't care about the time they spent on the moon. They wanted to see the training in Florida. Because there were people dressed in ordinary clothes behind them, which there weren't when they were on the moon, right? So we had done this with the kids. And the first thing the kids said when we actually read them a children's book, played them a section of an interview, and said, now what would you like to hear? The first thing they said, kids my age. Okay, so there were many ways to get at this. Here's one that was a real shock for us when we came up with it. When they teach things in school, the kids read stuff. Yeah? What do they want? Well, the kids don't really read, but they have science. Right? What do they want? The teachers. Things that relate to the things the kids read, right? So, imagine this query. You take a book. I don't know, Diary of Anne Frank. You tear a page out. You just stick it in the machine. And you get the interviews good for that page. Yeah? That's trivial. For us, it's a really long query. With a few of us. So, nice design ideas, because, you know, they were saying this and we're like, you know, well, that would probably be possible. We're like, no, that would be easy. Are you doing that? That's probably impossible. No, that's too easy. You know, that's probably impossible. Yep, that one's impossible. So the real trick was to get them to tell us all the things they were thinking of, because some of them were impossible, but they had no idea which ones. So this is an actual one. This was the age identification. Okay, of course, we only learned about the teachers we studied, and, you know, we only learned about the things you could see with this collection. We didn't learn about all of oral history or all the things you do with speech recognition. So, and very importantly, and this will be a big deal for you guys, we only learned how novices search. I mean, these were domain experts, but they were novices with the system. And you will find them. People will come, and in the last 5 minutes of your session, they'll actually start to get to that. And everything you've been doing was written for. There was somebody who turned in a user study thing and said, we'll do 5 minutes of training, and said, in the 5 minutes, we'll do these seven things. I don't think that's going to work. Okay, that's why you do pilot. Okay, so we did the user study with what now? So we go to IBM and we say, do your thing, make us a speech recognition system. So here's where they started, January 2002, with their three systems, 90% word error rate. Now, the usual way that they were doing this at the time was they were drawing 90% at the top, right below 100%, 0 at the bottom, 100 at the top, and they had all these graphs that were going down. And the speech recognition committee's been having trouble getting money for a few years now. They were like, you know, I really think if you just threw them our way, you'd do much better. So we told them this trick of flipping it over. Our collaborators in Chicago probably came up with this. So this was the first system they built. So this was only transcribing part of the data, and as they got more of the data integrated, this was the first system with all the data transcribed. So this is trained on 200 hours of transcribed audio from 800 speakers. Now, you can think of this as
they're kind of a minor bird, right? So the way a minor bird works is you talk to the bird, and it talks back, says what you said, right? So here what happens is you talk to the bird, and you type it, right? And then you talk to the bird, and you type it, and you talk to the bird, and you type it. And after a while, you talk to the bird, and it types it, right? So this is a typing minor bird. In 200 hours, you don't say very many words. It's amazing how well you can do with so little evidence. This system had a problem. The problem was, it was getting place names wrong. And it was getting people names wrong. Why? They don't show up very often in the New York Times or the Training Day, the place names that were being mentioned here. So, we had extensive metadata for all of the interviews. Now, you're thinking extensive metadata, you're thinking, oh, I saw that Dublin Core, right? We had 40-page pre-interview questionnaires that were filled out by hand and scanned, 52,000 of them, in 32 languages. Right? So, I mean, we had every place this person had been between the day they were born and the day of the interview. Every person they met and could remember from the day they were born to the day of the interview. So we had just massive amounts of information. They were designed for the interviewer to be filled out a week in advance, the interviewer reads them, and then can do a good interview. But of course we have the data. So we took all those names and dropped them in and we said, hey, they're likely to say some of these. The problem isn't to guess what they said. The problem is to guess where they said it. Right? I mean, we'll tell you right now, they're going to say this. Right? Okay, that gave us a little better than 5% improvement. So notice the number here. 40%. We made it on the first try. And then we got to 35% with this vocabulary prime. Vocabulary prime is not so unreasonable. Every time you have a source, you have information about it. So it's not an unreasonable thing to try. In the meantime, the people that were spending $1 million and then $10 million and then $100 million to get the better speech recognition kept spending money. And so we took this system and trained it on this data, but a better system, years later. So this is the best system that presently exists for the data. One word out of every four is wrong. And I told you before, all you have to get is 30% and you're okay. Right? And if you can get 40%, you gotta play some tricks. But if you got a 30% word error rate, you're fine. In news. And here we're at 25%. So this is exactly what you would want. I mean, if you were an IR researcher, this looks like heaven. This is, we want those three systems, and we just want to go do all our IR tricks.
Is that 25% just a batch process, or not even? Like, are you priming it with the places and people for that particular interview?
Yes, interview specific prime.
And are you helping it, saying this woman is from Poland?
No.
Polish accent?
No, we tried that and it didn't help because we didn't have, in the 800 people, there weren't enough people from Poland to get it. But that's the sort of thing you try. Okay. But it didn't work.
I can see writing a little code to know it's reasonable, but you weren't.
That's right.
Helpful.
This is for the 200 hour people. If you increase that base.
If you have more than 200 hours of transcribed training data, then you'd be better off. You're using a better accuracy. Okay? So right now, for example, for broadcast news, the accuracies are around 10%. There's a word error franchise. 90% of words are right. And there are commercial products you can buy that will detect broadcast news. All right, so now you already know this, but these are from public talks, and so they get 50 slides. So how do you build a test collection for this stuff? Well, you know, this is the way users work, right? They formulate their query, they do the search, they do some selection. And over here we got an index, and into the index we put the words kind of got a feature. And we can also put in the boundaries between the segments, because we want to search for segments, not for full documents. And we can put in the manual tagging. Or we can automatically do tagging. Or we can automatically find boundaries. So for example, to find boundaries automatically, what you do is every time they switch vocabulary, so they're talking about all these things, they start talking about all those things, they'll say, I'll bet you there's a topic boundary.
Or if they say, and now the weather, there's a topic now, right, in news. So you just have to learn. So if somebody says, can you tell me more, there's not a topic boundary there, right? So you can use the words, you can use the changeable vocabulary. Okay, so we have these things, fill the index, and then we search. First thing you do when you want to evaluate is get rid of that pesky user. Well, because, you know, the user just makes everything too hard to measure. And you have to replace the user with the topics. So we get the topic statements, we get the interviews, which goes through speech recognition, boundary detection, and content tagging. And down here we get rank lists out, relevant judgments, mean average precision, using. So if I give you a task collection, I have to give you in speech all six of those things. I have to give you the topic statements, the interviews, and if you don't want to do research on speech recognition, I give you the speech recognition results. If you don't want to do research on boundary detection, I give you the boundary detection results. And if you don't want to do research on content, I give you those. And of course, I have to give you the relevant statements. So we made a teensy-weensy little collection. There was somebody who said they were going to do 3,000 documents. I was like, 3,000 documents? People will laugh. Have you seen how many there are on the web? Right? But we did 8,000 documents. So you can now learn. All of this is on 8,000 documents. Why 8,000 documents? Well, at the time, the world's largest collection of speech for searching speech was the Trek collection. And it was about 400 or 500 hours. So we had 625 hours of speech in 297 interviews. And this took 3 months to do the speech recognition, with a bunch of people with white lab coats standing behind the machine, wishing they hadn't written the proposal, right? Just to try to keep the machine going, right? So this is a research class speech recognition system. So it's a very small collection from the IR standpoint. We ran the known boundary conditions. So we said, we're gonna take the interviewer's boundaries as given, just to see how well it works, right? How well can we find the thing in between the boundaries we know are there? It's another problem, how do we find the boundaries? We'll do that next. It turns out that there are an average of 503 words in every one of those segments from speech recognition. It may not really have 503 words. So they're an average of about 4 minutes long. All right, at the rate that they're speaking. We then created 96 topics. This took us 4 years. We created title, description, and narrative fields in the usual Trek style, where a title is something like a web query. Description is something like what you would say to a librarian. And narrative is something like what the librarian would know after having had a reference interview. Okay. So narrative is the basis for relevance judgment, and title is the basis for search, or title plus description, depending on whether you're modeling a rich query or a simple query. We split this into training and evaluation sets, and then we translated the topics into six languages. Actually, five languages, because one of the languages was English. So we got Czech, German, English, French, Dutch, and Spanish for everyone. So then you could ask questions like, well, if I ask questions in French, how well do I do at finding people who are talking about the Holocaust in English? Okay. And then we found two ways of getting relevance judgments. Way number one, which turned out to work the best, was that we hired graduate students at the University of Maryland who had expertise in library science and who had taken Dankert Circle's course. And we hired graduate students at the University of Maryland who had expertise in the Holocaust and people in history, for example. And then the people that had the topic expertise pick the brains of the people from library science about how to do this searching thing, and eventually put the people from library science out of business. Because the people from library science never were able to pick up the Holocaust background, but the people that had the Holocaust background were able to learn how to search in about a year of working side by side. So for the first year, we had both of those groups, and then we had domain experts after that. So we were developing a set of expert searchers who were domain experts. Those people
took the indexing that had been done at the Sherlock Foundation, learned the controlled vocabulary, and used the controlled vocabulary to find the documents, the segments, that were relevant to the topics. So now where did we get the topics? We got the topics by flying to Los Angeles in January. This was done by graduate students. To the back lots of Universal Studios, it's amazing they got anywhere at all, and going through every request that had ever been sent to the Shoah Foundation for information from the collection. This is back when the foundation was fairly new, so this was a small set of space under request. Found the ones that were for something other than this particular interview, but were topic-oriented requests, coded them all in a database, and then for the next several years we mined those and kept flying back out to Los Angeles to go through the actual requests and build track topics. So that's where the topics came from, and that's where the relevance judgments came from. But we then got dozens of our friends around the world to run experiments. This is really a cool trick. You don't have to run experiments. You just have to build collections. If you build a collection that is a really cool collection, everybody will want to run experiments on it. So we built a really cool collection, all our friends ran experiments on it, and then we could then take their results, pull them together a la Trek, find the highly ranked things, remove the things that had already been assessed, and go back and reassess the things the systems found that the people who missed. And then we can ask the question, who's better, people or machines? Because now we've got the things the people found, the things the machines found, the things both of them found, and of course nobody knows what none of them found. Right? Okay. And then we get this way to the world. So here is actual data. So if you're following along on your own slides, this will look a little different. And the reason is I don't want to send this data all over the internet. So the Docknill field simply tells us which of the original Shoah Foundation folder numbers this came from. So this one came from folder number 0561. Actually, no, sorry, it came from folder 9. I'm sorry. Start over. This is a document. This came from interview number 9. In our collection, which has the interview code 056.4. And this is segment 3 in that interview. And in that, a person whose first name is there on the screen and whose last name is obscured was interviewed. And that person was born in 1927 and had those other names. Okay? So every name that person is known by. The name of every person mentioned by that person in this segment is in the next one. So the name field is every person they mentioned. And it is subject to authority control only within the interview. So it's not resolved across interviews. If Isaac L., the same Isaac L., is referred to in another interview, we don't know that's the same. But if Isaac L. is ever referred to again here, we know it's the same Isaac L. The first time we distributed this, we didn't obscure the names. And the researchers, citing fair use, published one of these. In fact, this one. Never having thought that this might be personally identifiable information. But what this has in it is the names and birth dates of not just the person who was interviewed, but all their children. You could do a pretty good run on getting a credit card. So we weren't thinking, everyone was thinking copyright, and we weren't thinking privacy. So we've had to learn through this project that when you deal with things like email, when you deal with things like personal conversations, all sorts of privacy questions come up in evaluations that you wouldn't otherwise have to think about. Okay, the next thing is the manual keywords. So you can see that the indexer indexed this segment with Shabbat, and with Jewish identity, and with Presmeal Poland, and with food, and other things. Okay? And every one of these is indexed with this weird thing that is a combination of a location and a time. And we saw this and we were like, well, I've heard of this. This is a pre-coordinated descriptor, right? But what the heck is this doing here? Do you know why they did it? I mean, it doesn't save space, right? Now, I mean, there's a pole in the collection, you can't see it here, but in the collection there's a pole in 1939, a pole in 1940, a pole in 1941. These are all different descriptors. I mean, they could have saved themselves a lot of trouble by just saying Poland and separately 1939.
It doesn't do a lot to tell you about where they were in terms of the German occupation.
Why?
Well, because Germany didn't take over all of Europe overnight.
Yes.
It spread across.
Yes. Okay, so you could put dates on things that were other dates, but why put the date and the place together?
Because co-occurrence is not the same as that relationship.
Okay.
Right.
Okay,
I don't
know
that 1918 is about Poland.
If you Poland and France in 1918 and 1920,
yeah,
you don't know which year.
Okay, maybe. If somebody happens to be talking about Poland. So one of these is always indexed, sometimes more than one. The reason that they explained it to us, which was like, oh yeah, I hadn't thought of that, Poland kept moving. Poland's actually a different place in 1939 than it is in 1947. Right? And there's, on the wall at the Shoah Foundation, there's a sign that says, you know, you could have been born in this country, going to school in this country, you know, this other country, gotten married in this other country, raised a family in this fourth country, they get through six countries, and never move. Right? Because, you know, Europe is sitting here moving across you. So, anyway, that turned out to be a real mess for us because we could guess Poland from the words that were spoken, but we get the dates wrong. Or we could guess the dates, but we get the words wrong. And so we were getting counted wrong for this. Now, the next thing is a summary. So SL here recounts her daily activities. She knows her family's Jewish identity, and she talked about a typical Shabbat. SL describes home. So this is a very structured summary. It was designed to be put up in the search system as an explanation for why this got returned. And it's written to a standard. It is always three sentences long. It always answers the question, who, what, when, where. And in fact, it often duplicates what the computer is. Everything after that is automatically generated. So here's SL talking. December, when you talk about what your daily life was like, well, afterward, realized I was a little girl going to public school. We don't know where to put the period. Because SL never said period, comma, right? So the system doesn't know how to capitalize it. It doesn't know where sentence breaks are. Here's an interesting thing. Here's the better system. December, when you talk about what your daily life was like, well, after realized I, here's an even better system in 2006. December, when you talk about what your daily life was like, well, after realized I, do you notice anything in that set of three systems? They're identical. You know why? Yeah.
It's accurate.
There's no sense improving it. How could you improve it? You could just make it worse. So this is what happens. Speech recognition systems don't make mistakes by word. They make mistakes by interview. You have people that speak in ways that are difficult to transcribe. They get zero. You have people that speak in ways that are easy to transcribe. They get 100. And people that are in between, they get something in between. And so the whole game is being played. I've got this large number of people that we can't do anything with. I've got this large number of people we're perfect on. There's a very small set of people in the middle. And when I make my speech recognition system better, I get better on some of them. Okay? And then, averaging across all the words everybody ever spoke, my numbers go. But what's really happening is I'm finding better speech recognition that is better for a few people. So here's one example. So I flipped that off to fit on the slide. This is the full speech from a segment from a different interviewee.
because I have a story to tell you about Calendar, which is cornmeal. There wasn't much food that in the mountains we survived muesli and chestnuts, depending on the season, and cornmeal, I used to pick wild mushrooms, wild strawberries, and the mountain closed because somebody said it's huge, but wild asparagus, which grows very tall. Yeah, okay, so by the time we get better, you know it's not wild asparagus anymore, so it's very tall, but it's wild asparagus in our better system. Right? So this is a vocabulary process. And then here's the even better system, when we're back to wild asparagus. So it really was wild asparagus. We screwed it up by telling us that stuff, right? But you can see all sorts of other things, right? I have a story to tell you about Poland, right? Well, that's probably right. And schooling might be right. So you'd actually like to take all these systems, which are making different mistakes, for this one person, right? So you can use these multiple sources of evidence. And then what we did was we used text classification. Remember all that KNN text classification stuff? So we used it, and we guessed here, we built two different systems. They're both KNN systems. One of them forced us to have some things like Poland, November to August. The other one would allow us not to. These are just listed in order of our confidence. So we're most confident that this says cultural and social activities. Survey says no. Customs and observances Jewish. Survey says yes. Family life. Survey says no. So you get the idea. Now, did it really talk about family life? Seems like it's talking about family life, but no credit. Okay, so anyway, that's what's going on. So then the question is, how do I use all these things together? The thesaurus, they got a little carried away. It had 40,000 entries in it. So the first thing we did, this was kind of nasty. We wanted to guess how many thesaurus terms we should put on this, right? So we looked and we found out how many thesaurus terms are there on average, and the answer is 5. So our first guess was, okay, we'll always give you 5. Then we looked to see how many there really were. There were lots of cases where there were only 1 or 2, and there were a few cases where there were 20. We said, I wonder if the long segments get more thesaurus terms than the short segments. And it turned out the answer was, well, not really. As the segments get longer, they get more thesaurus terms until after a while the shorter ones are getting longer. So there wasn't much signal there. So this was just trying to sort of poke around and figure out what we could find. The average segment duration is 240 seconds. So then we said, I wonder if we can make our speech recognition system better by having it pay attention to when in the interview they say something. So this is an example of real data. So the first one is, this red one is pre-war political activities. They most often talk about pre-war political activities early in the interview. You really don't need a PhD to guess that, right? Okay. Then the next one is Berlin. So they talk about Berlin more often early in the interview than they do late in the interview. That makes sense. They're giving the interview in English, right? So they're probably someplace where English is widely spoken. And then there's war crime trials, the blue ones. And they never talk about war crime trials early in the interviews. Okay, that makes sense. So we say to ourselves, I wonder if we could just take these curves from some training data, feed them into our classifier, and make our classifier better. And so the answer is, you can. So then we said, okay, that's cool. I want to classify when they're talking about Berlin. Often when they're talking about Berlin, they will say, Berlin. So that's a good, well-correlated word with Berlin. Right? Or they might name some street in Berlin. Right, or some landmark in Berlin. I'm guessing they're talking about Berlin.
Then in the next segment, they probably won't say, now look, I'm still talking about Berlin. All right? They'll just go on. So what we did was we said, well, hey, we're missing all this. Why don't we just train it on what they said in the previous segment and guess the words for this segment? That does terrible. All right? I mean, just think about the extreme. Guess we'll train it on the words from the first segment and guess what they say in the last segment. Right? Be better to guess what they said in that segment. But how about if we add them up and divide by two? Maybe this will work, right? That turns out to work too. So, here is what happens when you do the time shifting classification. So you do the shifting time. You get no benefit for things that aren't locations. But for things that are locations, you get a benefit. It's kind of what you would have expected, right? They changed topics at the segment boundaries, that's why they segmented. But they didn't necessarily change locations. And then if I ask you whether you're early or late in the interview, if I bias you that way, you get an improvement if it's concepts, and you also get improvement if it's locations, as you saw with Berlin. Now you might say to yourself, fine, but this is a thesaurus, and I don't actually have to do classification right down to the last entry of the thesaurus. If I could just get you in the neighborhood, you could browse in the thesaurus. Right? So if I ask you, how close can I get you in the neighborhood? We have two kinds of hierarchies. So we have things like, literally just why Antarctica is in the thesaurus. But Antarctica is in the thesaurus, Antarctica 1945 to 2000, and it is of type continent by continent. Or it's by part-whole relationship, Antarctica. So we have ISA relationships and part-whole relationships. And we can move up the ISA, or we can move up the part-whole. And no matter which one we move up, our gains are preserved. Now, you shouldn't be letting me get away with this, because this is measured in terms of clipped arm precision. What the bleep is clipped arm precision? Right? Okay. So, in the first place, nobody in their right mind evaluates classifiers based on arm precision, that's clipped arm precision. Right? So what we did was we said, look, how many of these things should we generate? And the answer is, as many as we need. So we'll just count on the user to figure out when it's trash, and we'll put a ranked list of, not documents, but categories, to describe this segment. You remember I showed you early one that had lots of descriptions? And they were just sort of in alphabetical order, but here, they'll be in best first order, and you can just decide where to stop reading. So then, where should I cut it off when I evaluate? Well, some things should have a lot on, some things should have a short number on. So we came up with R precision as a way of doing it. But we're never going to have room to show you more than five of these. So we'll always clip it at five. And if R is less than five, we'll clip it there. Now, this was a problem in many of your batch evaluations. You gave me a description that said, here's what we're going to evaluate. Precision and recall. Precision and recall don't have anything to do with what you're trying to do. I guess, yes, but you taught us precision and recall, so we put precision and recall in here. Okay, we got some points now, please. Right? So it would be really good to think about what your evaluation measure measures and what you want to measure. And so we have to go off and invent measures to measure to answer the questions we want to answer. We can't always just pull a measure out of thin air. Let's see. Can I go another 5 minutes? Yeah? Okay. Here's a topic. And so what we're going to do is we're going to search on Jewish resistance in Europe, and that's going to be the game. So here's the results.
This is from 2006. This is the second last year of the train. This is now mistyped mean uninterpolated average precision. This is the measure you know as mean average precision. Right, so it's a familiar measure. And mean average precision, as you know, goes from 0 to 1. This graph goes from 0 to 0.1. So this is a tough problem. Right? These are the best people in the world with the results. They're up here about 0.07. So, I mean, this is something like, well, here, I'll show you some results further on. I'll give you an idea what that translates to. This is the Ottawa results, and this is Maryland results. So, it turns out you should be from Ireland, Canada, or Maryland if you want to do well at this, and you should not be from the Netherlands or Spain, which are the results. Now, these ovals indicate statistically indistinguishable runs. I mean, they're visually indistinguishable here, so it's easy to draw the oval. But we did a paired Wilcoxon test to determine that this is not a statistically significant difference. So we can't distinguish with this number of topics between those two systems. Here are our 2005 results of the previous year. This is our speech recognition result. This is our speech recognition result when we do query expansion. These are just title queries. And this is our result when we use the human assigned metadata. So you can see with the human assigned metadata, if this is a precision of 10 number, we get 0.48. That says that half of all the things in the rank list are relevant. And the things in the rank list are 4 minutes long, or 10 of them. So you probably have to go through two of them, or about 8 minutes of listening, to find something that you want to hear. This says about a quarter of the stuff coming out of speech recognition is relevant near the top of the list. Give you a feel for what you can get out of this. The numbers were somewhat higher than that. These numbers turn out to be wrong. Well, think about it. How many topics were there? A whole bunch, right? Which topic is this for? None of them, right? It's the average across many topics. That's what this means, right? So it's actually not true that this is half of that. The average across all of these is the average across all of these. Half the average across all of those. So we can look instead, and we can see how they compare. So this is topic 1188. This is topic 1179. And they're not in numerical order. What they're in order of is how much of the, how well we did, this is 100% of the metadata, did we do with just the speech? So the speech on this topic was pretty good. It was almost there. The speech on this topic was pretty good. The speech on these topics were, well, they weren't embarrassing, right? The speech on these topics was pretty bad, right? So from this, we came up with our most important conclusion. If you're going to search speech, ask about topic 1177. Right? Things will go well. Now, what was topic 1179? Well, we didn't actually do this for the good ones, but we did it for the bad ones. Here, topic 1188, remember our friend topic 1188? Don't let this happen to you. Topic 1188, we get 0%. So we can ask what's wrong with topic 1188. So here's topic 1188, Volkswagen Juice. Now, our speech recognition system has a little problem, and it never finds the word Volkswagen. It's not that it doesn't know the word Volkswagen, it's got a little tile in there for Volkswagen, but maybe people always pronounce Volkswagen in a way it can't get, or for whatever reason, it never guesses Volkswagen. even though Volkswagen appears in the metadata. It does, however, get Jews, which it then sends to Jew and matches with every word that sends in Jew in the collection, sends to Jew in the collection, which earns it a big fat zero in score, right? Okay. Here's another one, witness to Eichmann. This is the second worst, which it doesn't know. It knows Eichmann, but it doesn't ever get it. But it knows witness, so it sends it to wit and matches it with everything that sends to it. Not good. Okay, so if you look at the pattern here, what you see is we're getting a lot of missed words here. Above this point, there is not a single missed word. I mean, they might be missed in some places, but they're guessed somewhere. So now look at those words and tell me, what is it about those words that they have in common?
They all have weird pronunciations. I was saying gig carbon for the longest time until somebody corrected me. IG carbon.
What do they have in common besides German pronunciations? What's that?
The letter E.
They do have the letter E in common. How often do those words show up in the New York Times? Not very often. Except Volkswagen. I have no idea why we miss Volkswagen. But I know why we miss the rest of them. These words don't show up very often in the New York Times, and the rest of them do. Yeah? So, what's the problem here? The problem is the language model. So, several of you said, we're going to report the average precision across 40 topics or something like that. That's going to be our number. And I'm like,
would you maybe show me why some of them did better than others?
Would that be a kind of an analysis that would, for comparing systems? So that paired Wilcoxon test that I told you about is a very aggregate way of doing exactly this thing. And here you can actually see the results and maybe do something. We should take a break. And when we come back from the break, we'll take the last three systems, and then we'll pick up here next week and roll into, I think it's cross language next week after this. Okay. Good. So 5 minutes of calisthenics in the hallway. No enthusiasm.
I'm going to have a lot of doubts. I'm going to have a lot of doubts. I'm going to have a lot of doubts. I'm going to have a lot of doubts.
o'clock at night.
Bear in mind that these guys have had an extra week to do this, so it should be that much more impressive.
We start with a literature review and look for things like this that they're in Dr. Ord's or they can see things exactly like this, but I haven't found any yet. Some of the things I've found are applications that try to detect duplicate documents in large collections and applications that try to detect plagiarism. So both those can use IR techniques to try to identify similarities or derive documents, which is kind of what we're doing. But in our case, what we want to do is not actually find something that looks like you copied it from somebody else that actually is the document that you first identified. So there really is, from the user's point of view, there really isn't an information retrieval aspect of this. It's actually the user has identified a document that they're already interested in at the beginning of the process. And what the system's doing is just getting back to that document or the quote from that document that they want to use. Which makes the relevancy ranking nice because we don't care. We care a little bit. I mean, if it fails, we'd like to know the exact close. But for the most part, it should either get the document that we wanted or it's better. The way that it would work is it would be behind-the-scenes feature via black box. It would work kind of like the DOI system that's out there with Crossref and DOI, where you can have an identifier for a document that, in the case of Crossref, is anyone familiar with that? There's a the central organization that maintains these document identifiers for publishers for a particular article. And the publishers promise that if they change the URL where they're keeping that article, they will update the central repository so that the DOI, the numeric identifier, always works. And therefore, if you put a citation in your paper to a DOI or the website to a DOI, it goes out to the central database, look it up, and then goes to the publisher. And that way, you don't have to worry that the link is just not working. But the problem with that is that the publisher has to fill their part of the bargain. So the applications that we're seeing, there's two reasons. That addresses the link route issue. The other thing is having changes to the collection. If you have a large collection and you wanted to have bookmarks that worked in it, it would be fine if you had persistent document identifiers. But if you don't, then you're in big problems. You can get bookmarks that like this. Okay. So the idea is that you don't want to get 404 as strong because it's nerves. You want to be able to get back to the place that you were before. The requirements for the system is that the user be able to select a document or passage within the system. We're going to have a collection in the system we're building, a collection that we maintain on a hard drive. The user can work through that collection, select documents or passages of documents, and create bookmarks to them. The user can annotate those bookmarks, which, you can imagine if, say, we're using this for writing a paper or something. You could have your notes. You might want this for, the first paragraph, this about information retrieval or something like that. You could organize your thing that you wanted to use from the collection into a paper or something like that. And your bookmarks will allow you to annotate it and get back to the stuff that you wanted or work through your notes, things like that. The query that it uses, the idea is that it uses IR to create the bookmark. There is a query going on, but it's not one the user actually sees. Our system generates the query and stores it in a compact, efficient manner, and then uses it to get the document back. It doesn't tell the user, I'm searching on these words, or anything like that. It should be managing if it works right. It should work all the time. We're using the scene, and we're using the loop interface to work with it. And you'll see that in a second. We've got a more or less working website. And at this point, we're still investigating the various classes that are available in the scene that you can use to tinker with to try to make the query more efficient. And there's some interesting sort of theoretical aspects of that I'll talk about in the next slide. And we're using them. Okay, so there's things you can do in the scene to adjust the way the query works. And our goal is to adjust them so that they will be really good at finding identical documents, which is actually somewhat perverse request. Because that wasn't what the query engine was designed to do. It was designed to take a query and find documents that are about the stuff you searched on. So one thing that jumps out is that we spent a lot of time talking about how to adjust your document length. A query is a very short document, but documents you're retrieving are very long. You don't really care if you present a long document or a short document, et cetera, but when you're actually trying to get the same document back again, you might care that it's a long document or a short document. So one thing we can try to do with Lucene is fill with the document length weight factor there, that cosine normalization kind of stuff. The other things we can fill with is how many terms to date. Right now I've got something graphed at the top 25 terms based on inverse document frequency. Lucene actually has a more like this function in it, which just goes through and uses IDF to say, here are the terms in your document that are unusual in the collection. Take the top 25 of them, searches the D of any other document to have those unusual terms. And that's a nice way to start. But as you're doing this sort of exercise, there's things that are related to finding the same document again that are not, that are usually discounted in a normal query, like term proximity. If we have, and the number of times the term occurs in the document, something else you would go through the scene. So if you have to pick a term that occurs 10 times in the document, more than just relevance to making, that might be important information if you want to sort of identify that document. And then does term A occur within a certain space from term B? That might be more important for identifying the same document again than it is for identifying documents about the topic. We do a little demo, and ask Greg to come up and run through it. Send us to work on it.
One of the other things mentioned is this So basically, there are two parts of the system. The one is you have a bunch of. The idea is you've got a starting point, which is a document called a bookmark, and this is obviously not a good way to start because you have to browse through the different tools that you need from your time stories and say, but the idea is there'll be a little way to use services. But now you say, okay, I've got this document, and I want to create some kind of bookmark for it. And then this is the more like this basic, like we haven't done anything. It goes through and finds the highest yes idea of which terms. Here's a good query for this document. And if you want to save that bookmark, go ahead and say, well, this is what the tutorial is about. And then a week later, you can come back and say, remember I bookmarked that thing, and in case the URL is moved or for whatever reason, I want to try. Then you can say find a point, and it finds one document, which happens to be the one bookmark. In fact, it gets back an entire website. And it just the query generates a relevant score, and you say, well, relevant score is X, so you're going to say that's the one. I haven't yet found any cases where it returns more than one or doesn't return any, but it's not a match value, I'm pretty sure. So right now, I'll say one or two more things. The corpus here is just a bunch of New York Times articles and materials that we got. But one of the things that would be nice about the system is that it should be able to identify, should be able to find a document that may have changed since it was actually maybe a different later version of a breaking news story, or we thought of people move their pages on the web and they also rewrite them. So it would be nice if it were robust across time. And so one idea that I wish I had about that was go and actually find other versions of the newswire story and try to evaluate the parts and see if they return the changed version. And we could also do something actually like that Wikipedia. I have this Wikipedia article entry now, and I can get the one from a year ago, and I can bookmark the one from a year ago and see if it'll actually give me the one that's there. For this, I've yet to use that version. And the other piece of functionality that I'll mention is that you should be able to say, okay, this document might be really, really volatile, and I want to bookmark this particular paragraph right here. Instead of bookmarking the document, you probably have a bookmark document versus a bookmark passage of the document and then one bookmark document and be able to have the second, either the same query or a second query, look at the document, basically query the document for the passage and you're aware of it says, here's the paragraph of the section. Questions, comments,
Yes, let's add one application to mention. So first one should be because I work with LexisNexis. LexisNexis doesn't have documents. It's one of the data stages in the world. They have some terabytes of data, and they have document use, but they're not persistent. There's no way to come back a month from now and find a document based on my data. It's got a really good search engine. There should be a way to bookmark a document. And the other application I thought was personal knowledge base. Have their own sort of mission apps and documents, you call it, their enterprise knowledge base. It's kind of in flux, but you could throw the painting on it and use it to create fairly stable bookmark.
Well, if you want a really hard problem, you could do the congressional record where they say, now we'd like to insert this book here, please.
If the document is changed, you said that part of the idea behind the system is that if the document changes, you can still find it. If the document content changes, how does the query find it again?
Well, ideally, you would not have picked those few terms that happened to have been deleted from the document. So if there's going to be a trade-off, ideally, you want to get the query to be as efficient as possible. Choosing 25 terms kind of overkill, or maybe overkill because it almost always works. Then probably that last one, the one that's weak and informative, you can drop that off. So you want to trim this down to the point where it still works, but where it will be changed. And
I mean, yeah. If it changes too much, it's going to fail.
Yeah.
And the hope would be that it would fail some grades that they couldn't find documents, who's the top five of the license.
Right. So in that case, maybe it won't meet the threshold that we set. But if nothing meets the threshold, you can say, here are the top other 10, and you can rank where it falls in the document.
You
called
it
a
default. What kind of document?
These are news stories. Yeah, so we're thinking newsflash stories are often updated throughout the day. So we're matching this to the applied. We're matching newsflash to sort of the stories and articles and papers that we're written. We're not too much to setting any text about. Although the interesting thing that I didn't want to go up was the other technology is like this is document fingerprinting, where you try to create some kind of mathematical representation of a document and use that to identify copies of the document. And you can use that approach to a document that might be a photograph, something like that. It doesn't really care if it's a newspaper article or anything. It's just really, you know, sample it, it's just character, data, old, you know, rules like this, you can use crazy fingerprinting algorithms. And the question that I kind of have is whether, using information retrieval, I mean, that doesn't matter once your document changes because it'll still be about the same stuff. And so if you pick up the important terms you document, save those as part of the bookmark, then it doesn't change too much, and that combination of concepts might be a better way to point the document than just stamping every set of characters.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you.